Good morning. I would invite you to consider Rembrandt's version of this story as you're listening. And if you can't see it, well, that's what you get for sitting at the back. There was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said, "Father, give me the share of my wealth that belongs to me." So he divided his assets between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all that he had and traveled to a distant land. And there he squandered his wealth in dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout the region, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to the citizens of the region, who sent him to the fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled his stomach with the paws of the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired hands have had enough bread and to spare? But I am dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.' So he set off and went home to his father. But while he was still far away off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. Then his son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against you in heaven. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his slaves, 'Quickly, go grab a robe, the best we have, and put it on him. Put a ring on his fingers and sandals on his feet. And get the fatted calf and kill it. And let us eat and celebrate. For the son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they all began to celebrate. But the elder son was in the field, and he came and approached the house. He heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked, 'What's going on?' And he replied, 'Your brother's come back. Your father has killed the fatted calf, and because he's got him back and safe and sound.' But the brother became very angry and refused to go in. His father had to come out and began to plead with him. But the son answered, 'Listen, for all these years I have been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you have never given me even a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours has come back, who has devoured your assets with prostitutes, you kill the fatted calf for him.' Then the father said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and you have always been mine. But we had to celebrate and rejoice because your brother, he was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has now been found.'"
When we met as a worship committee to plan this series for Lent, I found myself resonating with this week's theme of Jesus confronting our priorities. As some of you know, at the end of January, I started a phase of life I call my semi-retirement from my work as a registered nurse. I now work as a casual or fill-in nurse whenever staffing needs arise at Lasard and Innisfree Hospice, where I've worked for the past 10 years. This means that my work commitments are very flexible and much more a matter of my choosing about when and how much I wish to work. It's a wonderful gift to have this opportunity at this point in my working career, but it raises for me new questions, many of which relate to our theme today. What will I choose to do with my time and energy released from my previous work commitments? Indeed, how do I determine my priorities? Thank you to Lorna for her reflections in experiencing the story about the parable of the lost coin. And Pauline, thanks for reading the parable of the lost sheep. I'll focus my reflections then on this story of the parable of the lost prodigal son. And perhaps in worship response, we can integrate all three stories because they have this lost theme of something, someone lost and returned and found. The parable of the prodigal lost son has spoken to me in different ways over the years. When I was younger, the familiar account of the errant younger son coming to terms with poor choices and being welcomed home by his father spoke to me about the graciousness of God to welcome all, including those who had sinned. In worship response last week, we talked about the power of parables to speak provocatively to people in all stations and stages of life. Amy Jill Levine points out in her book titled Short Stories by Jesus, The Enigmatic Parables of a Controversial Rabbi. Levine says that the parables have the ability to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. In my case, the message of this parable has continued to evolve over time, and I'm fascinated to notice what I'm paying attention to at this stage of my life. To that end, I'd like to examine the parable through the lens of how characters respond to different moments unfolding to them, and what this reveals about their current priorities. And I'll just mention, of course, the beautiful Rembrandt painting of this story and Rembrandt's interpretation of it, and the writing based on that painting that Henry Nouwen has created called The Return of the Prodigal Son, A Story of Homecoming. And it's a wonderful book in itself, but he really based his reflections on a very thoughtful looking at this painting. So the story illustrates important moments of decision for each character it depicts. First, the younger son's moment of decision. When he came to his senses, the scriptures say, he said, "How many of my father's hired hands have more than enough food? But I'm starving to death. I will get up and go to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son. Take me on as one of your hired hands.'" What do we learn about his priorities in this moment? For one, having gone against the traditions of his family and culture, he now must confront the full consequences of his past behavior. It is desperation that has driven him to this point of decision. And we can imagine and understand the potential for new growth and new life that is embedded within this moment at which he has hit bottom. In the end, he returned home to face the consequences. In so doing, he opened himself once again to relationship with his father, his brother, and all that might entail. What priorities did the father display in his significant moments in the story? And there are a couple, but we're going to focus on the moment of return. Thinking about the moment when, much to his surprise, the father learns that his son who was lost has returned, I'm struck by the unequivocal welcome he extends at the return of his younger son, who was lost from the family. Our text in Levine's translation says, "And yet, when the younger son was far off, his father saw him and had compassion, and running, fell upon his neck and continually kissed him. And said the father to his slaves, 'Quickly, carry out a robe, the first, and put it on him, and give the ring to his hand, and sandals to the feet, and bring the calf. because this, my son, was dead and he came back to life. He had been lost and was found. And they began to rejoice. What do we notice about the father's response? It seems to me that he met the moment in a way that was loving, kind, and courageous. Perhaps the pain of losing his son forced him to better know himself, and even the possibility, as Levine proposes, that he bears some responsibility for losing his son in the first place. To his credit, he quickly recognized an opportunity for reconciliation when it suddenly presented itself, and he thoughtfully directed his response to match his intentions. For Levine, it is clear that Jesus is portraying a family system in which not all is well, where everyone is struggling at times with behaving well. Although many of us can likely sympathize with the pain of being taken for granted by someone who is supposed to love us, the elder son reacts to the situation out of his pain, however justifiable it may seem. Again, with Levine's translation, the elder was in the field, and as he, coming, drew near to the house, he heard symphony and chorus, and he became angry, and he did not want to go in. And his father, going out, comforted, urged him, and answering, he said to his father, "Look, all these years I'm slaving for you, and not one commandment of yours have I passed by. And for me, not one young goat did you give so much that my friend might rejoice. But when your son, this one, the one who ate up your life, returned, you sacrificed for him the grain-fed calf." Here's what I notice about the elder's response. He is missing the moment. He speaks out of his pain and his sense of grievance and digs in his heels, consumed by his own perspective, not willing to enter into the spirit of joy for the lost being found that the Father has proposed, and not able to trust or embrace the possibility of reconciliation that is inherent in this moment. How can we better prepare ourselves for the moments that display our priorities? When we consciously consider our priorities, we recognize in part our limits as human beings, that no person has unlimited time and energy, so an important part of living is choosing where to direct our mind, time, energy, and resources. In a complex and busy world, it's an essential skill for our work, our finances, our family life, our community connections, and balancing different roles we play in each sphere. In matters of faith, priorities are equally important, for our beliefs are empty of meaning if we don't connect those beliefs with choices we make about our attitudes, behavior, and commitments. In the context of faith, then, we strive to have our priorities better align with our beliefs. I think the stories today offer insight on our priorities on two different timescales. In the case of the younger son, he's coming to terms with existing choices he has made that have brought him to a point of reckoning in his life that connects and links the past, present, and the future. This moment of reassessing life's priorities is like my own situation, entering semi-retirement that I described at the outset, a time of awareness that there are larger choices that can be made and a willingness to examine those choices. For the father and the elder son, the moments of significant decisions are on a much tighter time scale, much more immediate. And I'd like to spend a little bit of time reflecting on this aspect of the story. Knowing that at any time a circumstance may present itself in which our chosen response may have implications far beyond that encounter, how do we learn to choose well? What preparatory practices might we use to better align our priorities with those of Jesus when those moments inevitably come? Author and literary agent Douglas Abrams, who has collaborated with Archbishop Desmond Tutu on a number of writing projects, recalls an encounter with Tutu while meeting together over the course of a week to document his pioneering work with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. In the midst of a particularly exhausting time of interviewing for this project, Abrams asked Tutu about his decision to return to South Africa from England to better support the anti-apartheid movement, and in particular, how that decision impacted his wife, Leah, and their children at the time. Knowing from years of friendship and collaboration how hard it had been on Leah, and knowing how stressful that time was on their marriage, Abrams asked if Tutu had ever apologized to Leah for the pain of his decision had caused them. As Abrams' verbal challenge became more pointed, he could see that Archbishop Tutu drew his head back in reaction and understandable defensiveness. And then something remarkable happened. After only a split second pause, Archbishop Tutu collected himself and offered a thoughtful and engaged response rather than reacting with argumentative attack, as many in his shoes might have done when confronted on so intimate a matter. Later, reflecting on his encounter with Tutu and being deeply aware of the remarkable nature of the Archbishop's spiritual practice and teachings, Abrams explains that he now sees that this was a profound example of what a prayerful and meditative life can give us. That pause, the freedom to respond instead of react. Let me say that part again. A prayerful and meditative life can give us that pause, and with that, the freedom to respond rather than react. Reaction is an unconscious bodily response. It is often defensive in nature because it connects us with pain that we carry inside ourselves, ways perhaps in which we feel unloved or unlovable. Response is when we take a breath and calm our initial emotional and bodily reaction, pause to reflect on our priorities, and then choose a response to the moment that best fits with our desired priorities. To illustrate further, I'd like to share a story from my recent work experience as an RN providing bedside care at the hospice. I was recently caring for a gentleman admitted from home a couple days before, whose pain was controlled by an automatic pain pump. This device continuously gives a dose of pain medicine and also allows the person to give themselves an extra dose if they need it. As we got to know this person better and the symptom problems he was facing, the doctor had concluded the previous day that his sleepiness was likely caused by having too much pain medicine, and so adjusted the pain medicine to a lower dose and gave different medicine to treat some of the other symptom problems that he was having. In the late morning, his daughter arrived, but given my busyness admitting a new person at that time, I didn't speak to her until early afternoon. When we did speak, she mentioned that she had given her father two extra doses of the pain medicine, unknown to me. I was shocked. In our setting, if the resident cannot give the pain medicine himself, only the nurse is allowed to do that. Unfortunately, I reacted immediately, showing my dismay on my face, and somewhat firmly reminding the daughter about our policy. The instant I did so, I recognized my mistake. As I watched her face drop and realized she was likely blaming herself for causing possible harm to her father. I also realized, and she later confirmed, that she wasn't aware of the policy, and in fact had been told by other staff, either when they were at home or in our setting, that it was okay to do so. I immediately backpedaled and changed my approach, reassuring her that it wasn't her fault, and that the two extra doses would actually wear off in a couple hours. Unfortunately, the damage of my immediate reaction was done, and I could tell she remained distressed by this encounter for the remainder of the afternoon. Like the elder son, I was startled and reacted with what was foremost within me rather than my better potential. So I felt badly as I reflected on my reaction afterwards. When I finally had time to take a break, I found a quiet, solitary place and implemented a recent mindfulness practice I have begun to integrate into my work as a nurse. It involves a moment of quiet meditation to tune into my body, tune into my feelings, and to review what thoughts are circulating in my head. I quickly realized that I was not well-centered. I was tired. My shoulders and neck were tight. I felt anxious and unsettled. And my thoughts were stuck on that encounter. How could I have been kinder, less self-centered in my response to what the daughter shared with me? As part of the practice, I seek to return. And recently that word becomes kind of a mantra for me, return, and I'll unfold a little bit more what that means. It's a practice to seek a more centered, calm, less anxious, and overall a more loving state. It is a prayer practice that seeks to return to awareness of God's presence and love in that moment. As I did this, I noticed there was much for me to learn from a non-judgmental review of what had just happened. Clearly, I reacted. Unlike Archbishop Tutu, I did not rise above my reaction, but plunged into the moment, stuck within a reactive mode. Surprisingly, I realized that my reaction was in part self-protective, a defensive response. By immediately displacing the blame for that medication error onto the daughter, I conveniently glossed over the actual complexity of the situation. The reality is that I too had a role in the error. Despite knowing that she was an important caregiver for her father, I neglected to take about 2 to 3 minutes that would have taken to check my and her assumptions about the pain pump before the error occurred. But the point of the story is to notice that my reaction was emotional and in no small part arose from an unconscious defense that avoided confronting my own role in the error, and thereby overrode a more caring response I might have rather made had I paused and returned, like Archbishop Tutu would encourage us to do. By the way, one additional note about that encounter Mr. Abrams had with Archbishop Tutu. Sometime later, Archbishop Tutu mentioned to Abrams that in follow-up to that intense encounter, he did finally go ahead and apologize to his wife, Leah, for putting her and the children through that difficult experience, and it went very well. During worship response, I look forward to hearing your ideas on practices that have prepared you to better meet the moments of your life, or stories from your life where such moments went well or not so well, and how you navigate priorities in your life of faith. Together at BMC, we are on a journey, and Jesus has given us teachings that lay out a vision to guide our path for a life well lived. On Friday, at the funeral of Paul Snyder, the family chose scriptures that reminded us that God has prepared a home for us, a place where our spirits, like Paul and Martha, will finally rest in a homeland where kingdom priorities reign with justice, mercy, and kindness for all. Jesus calls us to live that vision as best we can in the specifics of each of our many different paths as disciples of Jesus, moving toward that homeland, lived in the soil and circumstance of our lives, empowered by that vision. Like the younger son, may we return toward home each time we discover that we have strayed, and in so doing, remember that we are forever held by the love of God, so measureless and strong, which is the source and foundation of our lives and our hope.